Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, June 19, 2013, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simon, sitting in for Mike McKean, and here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Marty Steffens and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, there are some new developments in the NSA surveillance story. Word the U.S. and British governments were intercepting communications at the G20 summit in London back in 2009, creating buzz as the G8 met in Northern Ireland this week. And The Guardian held an online chat with Edward Snowden with members of the public submitting questions. It's prime time for the Supreme Court to hand down its decisions before going on summer break, and a lot of folks are waiting to find out whether the Defense of Marriage Act is held up or if same-sex marriage could become the law of the land. The Pew Research Center released a study this week analyzing media coverage of the issue and finds it skewed. We'll talk more about what it found. And we'll also talk about another federal court decision that's come out this past week, this one from a lower court that's likely to be of great interest to our college community, unpaid internships. A judge ruled that Fox Searchlight should have paid two production interns working on the film Black Swan. It's rekindled the debate over unpaid internships for employers, for educators, and for students. And an incident in a London restaurant is making headlines around the globe. The Sunday Mirror published photos of celebrity chef Nigella Lawson arguing with her husband, who is said to have grabbed her by the throat. He called it a playful tiff. Meanwhile, she took her children and left the family home. At issue, why the paper chose to publish these photos and why no one in the restaurant came to her aid. There's a lot more that hopefully we'll have time to get to, too. But first, let's start with the latest drama surrounding NSA surveillance leaker Edward Snowden. His father spoke exclusively with Fox News' Eric Bolling, urging his son to come home.
We love you and we want you to come home. We want you to be safe. We want you to be happy. But I know you're your own man and you're going to do what you feel that you have to do. I believe firmly that you are a man of principle. I believe in your character. I don't know what you've seen, but I just ask that you measure what you're going to do and not release any more information.
This, while the public got its first shot at Snowden through an online Q&A facilitated by The Guardian on Monday. Half a dozen staffers were on site, presumably in Hong Kong, selecting questions and guiding that discussion. You can read a full transcript from it on our links blog. Ernest, why do this? Why take reader questions?
I think it's just another avenue that the media can take in order to get the story out or to get a version of the story out. And you also have this audience participation going on, so that keeps the story going as well. And you have a lot of people out there who are interested in it, and they have questions about why he did it, why is he in Hong Kong, does he have any plans to come back to the U.S., is he afraid of being charged with treason, and those types of things. So that really keeps the story going.
Did anything come out of it, though, that we didn't already know?
I didn't hear anything that come out of it that we didn't already know. I don't think that they're going to release any new information. I think that some classified information that he may have may be an actual threat to national security. And The Guardian and other newspapers may feel as if, you know, they're going to put themselves in some sort of jeopardy, either legally or in the public's eye, if they release information that is deemed to be a threat to national security.
Now, we keep hearing there's more, there's more, there's more. We're almost 2 weeks into this story, and I'm wondering, have we seen more yet?
I don't think we're going to see any more. I think we're pretty much where we're going to be right now. The question now becomes whether or not the public is going to see these leaks and this whistleblowing as something that really warrants a change in the laws that we have when it was centered around national security and centered around the state of the government being allowed to listen to our phone calls or tap into our messages and that sort of thing. And right now, we just don't see that sort of public backlash against that.
Why do you think that is, Marty? Why does it seem people aren't as outraged as you might?
Well, there's several things to kind of draw on. One is, this is very analogous to the cable leaks that we had a couple of years ago. And to kind of a point of history, those actually spread out from February to about September of 2011. So you had kind of that, those cables, kind of, which was a quarter million cables, leaked out over a period of time. My guess is, as Ernest says, they're probably doing a little bit of fact-checking to make sure that they don't get in trouble or that they have things in contest, especially because the Guardian's becoming under increasing scrutiny to say, how do you know that what this guy is right? But I think the backlash comes from the standpoint that I don't think it surprised a lot of people that there is this kind of surveillance going on. For one thing, it's pretty popularly accepted in movies and the like to, you know, I can recount several scripts where somebody's like linking into the NSA database and looking over, you know, intercepting transmissions, phone calls, that kind of thing. And so I think because of that, I think there's kind of popular acceptance that that's going on anyway. The NSA has been around for a long time. And if you recall, that's their chief mission, was to intercept communications and as an intelligence process. So I really think that that's why there's a little bit of a acknowledgement that maybe some of this people knew that some of this stuff was going on.
I think part of it too is that, and we talked about this last week, that the public is sort of has this perception that, you know, the government has always had the capability and has used that capability to spy on us. Business does it all the time in ways that we're pretty conscious of, when we use our gas cards, when we use our credit cards, when we use our
Facebook,
social media. So I think the public is like, okay, why should anybody be surprised about this? I think what's happening is that you have a lot of people, especially those who are interested in civil liberties, who are saying this is taking it a step too far. And now we're on a slippery slope to losing some of our civil liberties in the name of national security. And from historical perspective, when that's happened, what we seem to have going on as we continue down this path is someone's going to abuse that power and going to abuse it in a way that it was not intended by the government or by the public.
And if you think of the News Corp hacking scandal, I mean, that was surveillance, but where the media surveilled by hacking into voicemail and not just listening in, they were actually hacking into voicemail. So, you know, you have that issue as well.
So, changing gears slightly, late June is always a busy time in Washington as the Supreme Court hands down decisions. We're still waiting for those to come. We expect on affirmative action, a challenge to the Voting Rights Act and same-sex marriage. A study from the Pew Research Center shows the media is likely to present a more supportive view of same-sex marriage rather than an antagonistic one. It analyzed a sample of mainstream media coverage from late March and found that just less than half of the 500 stories covered during that time focused on support for the measure. 9% focused on opposition and 44% were neutral. For a story to be classified as supporting or opposing, statements within the story had to outnumber the opposite view by at least 2-1, and anything that didn't meet that threshold was considered neutral. One of the things that stood out to me in this study is that the researcher said the numbers seemed to hold true for all three of the cable news networks, for CNN, for MSNBC, and for Fox. Ernest, what can we take away from that?
Well, I think what you can take away from that is that the media has finally caught up with the public. This is not new when you look at media over its history. It usually follows the public, and I think public thoughts, public feelings on same-sex marriage has shifted, and has shifted more toward the acceptance of same-sex marriage, and I think the media is sort of following in that same pattern.
Right. When you look at how you construct a story, which is you get comments from different sides of the issue. I won't say both sides, but different sides of the issue. One of the things that's happened, particularly since 2011, is that the advocates for same-sex marriage have pretty much, it's kind of become common to frame opponents of same-sex marriage as bigots, that this is a discrimination issue, much like the 60s when you had interracial marriage and attitudes changed on that, or interracial adoption, or you know, other kinds of equality issues over time. So now when you have the opponents of same-sex marriage framed more in a bigoted terms, you're going to get far fewer spokespeople making comments. They're going to be, it's going to be an underground sort of resistance. There's still a large traditional resistance to same-sex marriage, but I think they're much less common to talk about it. They just feel very reluctant. They worry about being branded as a bigot.
And that resistance kind of came out a little bit in this study and the analysis of use and what people were saying on Twitter. There were three segments, Twitter being one of them, that were pulled out of this study and looked at aside from the mainstream media, among those being LGBTQ publications. And then the Huffington Post was singled out and studied and analyzed separately. What do we make of that, Marty?
Well, that was largely because the Huffington Post has a huge volume of that content. One of the things that Huffington Post does very well is really discuss social issues. And because they have so many columnists who weighed in on that, when you look at the bulk of news, when you search Huffington Post, you'll really see that a lot of their columnists did that. They also have a pollster update, so they talk quite a bit about polling, sentiment, and the like. I think it just plays to the Huffington Post's strengths, which is a commentary on social issues.
And I think that when you right now, when you look at the media landscape, a lot of media operations are starting to find niche issues like same-sex marriage and healthcare and those things. And they're really honing in on that, and they're able to draw in people who are really interested in that. And they can have columnists to talk about it. They can conduct polls, as Marty was talking about. And that draws eyeballs to and readers and viewers to their sites.
Right. HuffPost thrives on clicks. And you're not going to get more of a hot button click issue than gay marriage. So you're really going to drive. I mean, if you go into the Huffington Post headquarters in New York, you really see how they're always counting the numbers. And those are going to drive eyeballs.
Okay. Well, we'll have to see how the court comes down on this in the next few days. In New York last week, a federal judge ruled that Fox Searchlight Pictures violated federal and state minimum wage laws by not paying production interns on the film Black Swan for work they did that would have otherwise been done by paid employees.
The film industry does a lot of freelance work. You go from gig to gig to gig to gig. And I kept encountering this again and again and again. People looking for trained professionals to do work for free. And I just got increasingly incensed about the fact that it was illegal and yet it was so prevalent.
That was one of the interns who brought this case up against Fox Searchlight. Experts are saying that this case could end up upending the long-held practice of unpaid internships in the film industry and others that rely on them heavily. Traditionally, ours, the news industry, has been one of those. Marty, you and I work very closely with students looking for internships and helping place them in those situations. What impact do you see this decision having on
them? Well, you're not just this decision, but there was another decision a little bit more than a year ago that related to magazine interns, and we saw an immediate response. Condé Nast and Hearst all of a sudden started dismantling their 40-hour-a-week programs, scaling interns back to as little as 16 hours a week, which kind of makes things a little problematic, because they're really afraid of being sued. And so we're seeing this. Now, the advertising industry so far, public relations industry, we're still seeing some 40-hour internships. But the magazine industry, already taken heat.
I know I ran internship programs for years before coming here, and one of the things I was always reminded is that the internship by law has to benefit the student as much as it does the newsroom, which really complicates things because we want to have these folks there to actually help out and to contribute in some way, but we can't be asking them to do the work of a regular paid employee because we're not paying them. How do you strike that happy medium?
I'm not sure how you strike that happy medium. I mean, one of the things that I think is really driving this is the fact that you have more and more interns are coming in and they're working these hours and they're not getting paid. On top of that, they have the heavy student loan debt. So they're working for free in a profession that they want to get into while still having to live and take care of themselves. A lot of them have to take care of themselves. Not all of them are depending on their parents for funding, and they have the student debt. So it's become a real, real big issue in terms of what's happening in employment across the board. I've never been one that's been in favor of unpaid internships. I think that there are a lot of companies out there who could pay minimum wage or minimize the hours, but you can figure out some sort of way to compensate these interns for the work that they're putting in.
Well, what we're seeing, too, is the recognition or the insistence upon some employers who have free interns that these students then get course credit.
Which costs them,
right? So it's kind of a double-edged sword. Not only the parents are paying for housing for a student in New York to work for free, but they're paying for course credit on top of it.
It's an issue that I think that you're starting to see backlash from parents, you're starting to see backlash from students, and I think that universities are going to have to decide what side of the fence they're going to be on. And I would think that they're probably going to be on the side of the students, which in a lot of ways is going to force these companies, force businesses and government too, because government plays a huge role in this, because they have interns as well. It's going to force them to come to some kind of decision in terms of how they're going to use interns. And there needs to be some form of compensation for that.
Well, it's definitely going to be a challenge for us in the coming weeks and months and years to figure out how we do that. Let's talk a little bit about 3D. A few years ago, 3D TV was kind of looked at as the next big thing, the logical successor to high def. But now ESPN is ending its run on ESPN 3D, its channel that showed selected sporting events in that format. Marty, is this the death blow to the idea of 3D at home?
Yeah. People never liked wearing glasses. Then they came out with TVs that you don't really need glasses. But honestly, right now, televisions are a commodity, meaning you really strike the lowest price. There's a lot of really good quality TVs. So the only way that the TV industry can make a little bit of money is by adding a little bells and whistles. 3D isn't it. It's kind of like the beta versus VHS debate. You know, people, it's just not exciting enough for people to pay for it. People see it as a gimmick. It's kind of too intensive to watch. If anything, I blame it on the second screen syndrome that we all have watching television. You cannot watch 3D TV and then go down and look at your iPad and then look back up at 3D TV.
Not without vertigo.
That did it.
That's true. And I think ESPN took a chance. Yeah. They took a chance that this would take off, especially in the realm of sport, because people want to be up close and into the action. And it just didn't work out for a lot of the reasons that Marty was talking about, because it's very difficult in today's world for people to sit and actually watch a game for the entire game. They're up, they're around doing other things. They're looking at their computer screens. They're on the phone. They're looking at their phones for updates on Twitter or email or text messaging and that sort of thing. And it just didn't work to keep taking your glasses off as you're moving from one screen to another. But if by chance 3D does reappear, ESPN has the technology. It can jump right back into the game, or it could take that technology and use it and expand it into something that we haven't seen before, we haven't heard of before. So I think that they took a chance, they spent some money, but I think in the long run, they're probably going to be able to benefit from this in other ways.
I think as we look at glass screens, I think that's probably, you know, what's going to be the next technology is if you start seeing things on glass instead of behind glass, then I think it's going to have a dimension that people would like and bring you into the picture, as it were.
We'll see what happens there. Another ESPN story to talk about, this one at an ESPN radio station. Three hosts at 790 The Zone in Atlanta were fired after making fun of former New Orleans Saints player Steve Gleason. Gleason has ALS, better known as Lou Gehrig's disease, and is now confined to a wheelchair. He wrote a column for Sports Illustrated Monday in which he detailed his battle. The three hosts took that column as fodder for a skit on their show.
Knock, knock.
What? Who's there?
Smother.
Smother who?
Smother me. Do me a favor. Knock, knock.
There's a third one, huh? Who? God help me. Who's there, Steve?
I'm
who?
I'm going to hell.
The three hosts, Steve Shapiro, Nick Cellini, and Chris Dominino, were all fired and gone within hours of that incident. Station management has issued a formal apology, and Domino tweeted in which he said, "I have so many people I have to apologize to. I know this is not who I am, but it is who I am today. An apology here means nothing if I don't reach out to all of the people I need to. I'm in that process as we speak. Friends and family, and most importantly, those I know I hurt." Ernest, does an apology like this cut it?
No, this doesn't cut it. They They were fired. They should have been fired. Someone in management needs to reach out to everyone else who's at that, who's working at that station, and let them know that this kind of behavior is not going to be tolerated. But what it really speaks to is that there was someone in that room, either one of the three of them, a producer, someone should have raised their hand and said, wait a minute, guys, this is going too far. And when you get into this sort of shock jock mentality, these are the things that you run into, and there needs to be someone there, a grown up there, who can raise their hand and say, wait a minute, this is stepping over the line. Let's pull it back. If we're going to talk about this issue, which is an important issue, we need to talk about it in a mature and meaningful way so that we can inform our public and not use it as some sort of, you know, some sort of joke to, you know, gin up ratings, if that's what they were trying to do.
Marty, what do you think? Is this a career killing act, or is this something people are going to forget about and move on?
Oh, for these guys, I think it's going to have a diminishment on their career for about 2 years. That seems to be the lifespan of those kind of embarrassment things, and they'll kind of end up in a smaller market and kind of get their way back. Kind of like that West Virginia guy who, you know, cursed on the air. They will find their way back or find their way to another job. But yeah, it's probably going to have a career impact for 24 to 36 months.
What kind of memory do you guys think that the audience has about something like this? Forget the station managers who are the ones looking and vetting people before hiring. But what about the audience?
Well, I think the audience is, you're going to have some in the audience, maybe a lot in the audience, who are going to move away from this station for a little while. I mean, they'll eventually come back, especially if it's an ESPN affiliated station, because they have a corner on the market in terms of what it is they put on the air.
Well, and this station is also the home to the Atlanta Falcons.
Well, and there you go. Yeah. So they're going to have that. So you're going to have people going to move away, but then they'll eventually come back. But I think in the long term, the station is going to have to mend some fences there, because this is one of those instances in which you can really damage your reputation with a certain segment of your audience if you don't move in a direction that shows that you really understand that this issue is something that should be dealt with in an important and mature way, and not as in a shock jock way.
I think the audience will come back dependent on who the replacements are. I think that the memory will be very short. I think that, you know, the hours and hours spent watching, you know, the Falcons or other kinds of sports or listen, you know, they'll come back for the programming. And if they don't like the host, then they'll stay away. I think that the memory will be very short.
Okay. Well, most of us know celebrity chef Nigella Lawson for her Food Network show, Nigella Bites, and as a judge on ABC's The Taste. She and her husband, Charles Saatchi, are in the spotlight after having a fight in a London restaurant.
She's always portrayed as a very powerful woman, a woman in control. So for her to be so sort of subservient, I think is a rather telling story.
Nigella Lawson and her husband Charles Saatchi are making British tabloid headlines like Choke Attack, Boiling Point, and Nigella's Tears after pictures surfaced showing Saatchi's hand around his wife's neck during an apparent argument at this upscale London restaurant.
What you see is a woman who's very distressed, and I believe a man who's very much in control.
The center of this are these photos taken by onlookers and published in the Sunday People, a subsidiary of the Mirror. In them, you can see a visibly distressed Lawson with someone's hands wrapped around her throat and her nose being pinched. There has been a police investigation, and yesterday Saatchi accepted a caution, which is a written warning issued for minor crimes in Britain that threatens arrest should there be another offense. Meanwhile, Lawson's publicist says she and their children have left the family home. This isn't the first time we've seen or heard about domestic abuse among celebrity couples. The problem is as real for them as it is for us regular folks. But it's raising eyebrows because the bystanders in this case, they simply stood by. No one intervened. Marty, what is it about our culture that has changed, that a couple becomes visibly violent in public and instead of reaching to split them up, you reach for your camera and take pictures of it?
Well, it's the fact they sold those pictures to the tabloids. You know, they're all of a sudden starting to see dollar signs, and it's sort of like, well, okay, these people can take care of themselves, but it's not my responsibility to split them up, but it is my responsibility to make a few bucks off this photo. So I think everybody's sort of getting that taste of the fact that they can profit from other people's problems or their proximity to a celebrity doing a bad thing. It's all over, whether they put it up on YouTube or sell it to a newspaper. And I think that is kind of hurting, you know, just personal integrity.
I also think that we've gone into an era in which people just don't want to get involved. They don't feel like it's their responsibility to step in when situations like this happen. And I think Marty's right in terms of people grabbing their cell phones, because I mean it's the voyeuristic mentality that we see just all over the place. I mean, you saw it in the Boston Marathon. You saw it in a lot of instances.
In the Columbia shooting.
Yeah, that's right.
The photographer didn't waver when shots were fired. I mean, you know, it's a pretty steady cam, you know, through the entire incident.
Yeah. So I think that's exactly what's happening here. But I think it's sort of a danger in our society when things like this happen and no one steps in and say, well, wait a minute, you know, you can't just, you know, put your hands around any person's neck in public and be able to sort of get away with that.
Well, and as a result, The Independent, another newspaper in England, has decided that it is not going to be publishing them. It's not going to continue to cover this and is taking a stand based on that ethical, we need to move ahead and do what's right in terms of being human, in terms of humanity.
I think that's the way in which the media needs to do this. But the problem with that is that because, you know, we have the tabloids.
That's a slippery slope of self-censorship. Though.
Exactly. I mean, you if you don't do it, someone else is going to do it. And then they're going to get the ratings. They're going to be able to make the money. And then we fall into that pattern, too. So it's a pretty confusing place for the media to be.
Okay. Well, before we go, I want to talk about another photo that appeared in print. It's a follow-up on a story we talked about at length about 2 weeks ago, the Chicago Sun-Times decision to lay off its entire photojournalism staff. Now we're starting to see the consequences of that decision. Sunday, this appeared on page 15 of the paper's print edition, a story about friends from Chicago and Boston coming together to watch the Stanley Cup final between the Blackhawks and Bruins. Reporter Becky Schlickerman is credited with both the byline on the story and the photo that ran above. For our radio listeners, our online and TV audience are now looking at a photo of five men standing arm in arm, with one of them wearing a T-shirt that reads, pardon my language, I am surrounded by jagoffs. Ernest, we said a few weeks ago, photojournalists see things the rest of us just don't see.
Well, this is one of those instances where you need to have the experience, both as a photographer as well as an editor. When you see something like that, do you use that photo or do you not use that photo? Do you crop that out? There are ways in which you could have still been able to run that photo, but not have the offensive language in there. And this is where the Sun-Times is going to see problems when you don't have the people with the experience there to make those kinds of decisions.
Newspapers have cut staff across the board about 24% since 2000. And stressed newspapers like the Chicago Sun-Times have had even deeper cuts. Mm-hmm. So this is an ongoing conversation, which how much staff, what's the quality that is really needed to provide the checks and balances to publish on the web and in print. And this is kind of one of those cases where they're just so short-staffed, nobody took a second look. I remember back in the day when we were three deep in terms of editors.
Well, like always, we're out of time before we're out of things to talk about. Thank you for joining us, listening and watching. There's more background for today's topics on our Links blog under the Talk Shows tab at kbia.org. You can also replay the show and leave comments for us there or send them via email to views@kbia.org. RJI's Travis McMillan directs our show, and KBIA's Pat Akers handles the audio. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to listen in next week. Mike McKean will be back with Ernest and me for another edition of Views of the News.